the whole asymmetry creates issues, complications. It impacts us or puts a strain in a relationship. Who is excluded? Who is more the birthright to this product? In other words, that if it's, let's say, a sperm donor is from a stranger, so the chance of the, you know, father feeling, am I really adequately, sufficiently related that I could claim fatherhood?
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Molly Mann. Dr. Mann is a training and supervising analyst and a child supervisor at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. And we discuss her lifelong work around the area of assisted reproductive technology. She wrote a book, edited a book, entitled Psychoanalytic Aspects of Assisted Reproductive Technology. It was well-recognized. It won the Pinnacle Book Award. It won the International Book Award in Family and Parenting and Family category in 2016. And it was a finalist for the Book Vanna Award, also in 2016. And we take up the issue of infertility and all its many manifestations, but we begin very importantly with recognizing that an old idea is an old idea that hasn't served time or the field or patients well, and that is unconscious fantasy is not responsible for infertility. That said, there's much that psychoanalysts can do to assist the process of working with infertility, and we go through examples, clinical examples that she has about the kinds of difficulties she works with and the kinds of patients she work with. We also take up the very challenging question of either egg or sperm donors and how difficult that is, who you choose, when you choose, when do you tell a child of their biological origins? And of course, this relates to issues of adoption as well. And we close with Molly sharing her thoughts. She's a senior child analyst, and she's aware that certainly in the States, child analysis is struggling, and she comes up with some creative ideas about how we might be able to approach it differently than we have to the good of both the field and the trainees and the patients. She has written widely. Just a sampling of some of her papers are Immigrant Parents and Their Immigrant Adolescents, The Tension of Inner and Outer Worlds, Aggression in children, origins, manifestations, and management through play, the formation and development of ethnic identity. She is also a poet, and she's published 2 books of poetry. And she mentioned that she and her husband were members of Flying Doctors for nearly 3 decades. And I learned a great deal from reading her book, and many of us have experiences, whether they be social experiences, relatives, personal experiences, clinical experiences, with the world of infertility. And I am pleased to have learned about Molly's experiences and for her to share her wisdom with us. So here's my conversation with Dr. Molly Mann. Molly, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Thank you, Harvey.
Molly, we have for a very long time been familiar with a particular clinical phenomena. And that phenomena is that when patients come to us presenting with symptoms, they could be interpersonal symptoms, they could be somatic symptoms. What happens if things go well is that over time and with their immersion in a deepening dynamic process with their analyst, the nature of those external symptoms will start taking shape in the analytic relationship. They'll be morphed so that the patient's perception of the analyst and the relationship will take on characteristics that contributed to the onset of those symptoms in their outside life, which always and continues to strike me as fascinating. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing because, number one, it softens, if not eliminates, at least temporarily, those symptoms in their outside life. And it also allows us to sort of get our hands around the essence of those symptoms so that we can deal with them between the two of us in vivo instead of in effigy. It should be said also that that's a challenging aspect of treatment, and it often can be derailing, but can often be powerfully curative. And given the frequency of this phenomena, it's understandable that generations ago, analysts assumed that when patients came to them with what was then called psychogenic infertility, that the same thing would happen, that the constituents, the neurotic constituents of the psychogenic infertility would emerge within the transference, and then the symptom outside would go away. And it is clear, this artificial experiment that was run, the results have been in for some time now, and the results are that that doesn't work. That, in fact, that infertility of unknown origin is not generally curable through a dynamic treatment. And you make this very clear at the very beginning of your book called Psychoanalytic Aspects of Assisted Reproductive Technology, when you write as follows, quote, "Making claims about the causality of infertility and the concept of psychogenic infertility is not a useful argument for us as psychoanalysts. Conscious and unconscious hostility towards a defective male sibling or a woman's unconscious repudiated femininity or motherhood can be important dynamics. However, there are couples who are able to conceive naturally in spite of similar dynamics. We need to be careful not to confuse the correlational data with causality." A very important point to remember. Which is in no way to suggest that we analysts have nothing to contribute to people who present with infertility. We have a great deal to contribute, as we're going to learn today. Just to give a sense of how widespread this issue is, using IVF, in vitro fertilization, as sort of the paradigmatic assisted reproductive technology, it was first done in 1978, and since then there have been over 10 million births born that way since 1978. There are between 500,000 and 750,000 babies born every year through IVF. differing widely by country. For example, in Denmark and Japan, there are about 10% of the children are born through IVF. In Israel and France, there are about 5%. In the United States, it's between 1% and 2%. And the reasons for this probably have more to do with insurance reimbursement than anything else. As a side effect, if that's what one would call it, from this widespread use of in vitro fertilization, there are estimated now 1 million embryos that are in storage and are awaiting. We'll leave it there. They are awaiting. I thought the best way we could begin to acquaint the listener, and I say acquaint the listener with this issue. So many of us are familiar with this issue from patients, from relatives. It is in our zeitgeist. Even in the younger generations, we hear how quickly people will go to in vitro fertilization, even if they're fairly young in age and haven't been trying the old-fashioned way for some time, which is a story unto itself. But Molly, you have written up a patient, a fictitious patient, a composite patient called Jean, who really is a very good example of the kind of patient who presents and struggles with these issues. So how about if we begin by your telling us a little bit about Jean, then reading somewhat from what you've written about it, and we'll use her as a jumping off point to consider many of the issues that we see in the office and perhaps in our lives as well.
Exactly. Thank you, Harvey, for a wonderful introduction about the whole theme of the IVF. The case that I mentioned in my book has the name is Jean, and she was married, a woman of 48 years old, and she came to psychotherapy, and I've seen her for twice weekly dynamic psychotherapy. After about a year or so, she decided that she wanted to go into full analysis 4 times a week. And she was, prior to that, she tried on her own to get pregnant, and she could not. But this was something that was on her mind when she wanted to deepen her treatment.
And this was at the age of?
This was the age of 49.
She was 49 years old. Now, when she was trying to get pregnant on her own, do you know how young she was when she was trying?
She was trying to get pregnant when she was in her 30s. Uh-huh. So it was a long stretch of trying and trying, and didn't happen. And she considered IVF at this point.
Okay.
When the second time around, when she came to see me, you know, because she was also very focused on her professional life. And she and her husband, they were in a similar field. And, you know, that whole idea that she was taking a lot of pride in her own work rather than focusing on becoming a mother and the value of motherhood. And so that was her explanation, conscious justification of why she had delayed as long as she did delay. So then that felt like she felt like, you know, if her work is perfect and flawless, that is a huge achievement. And it does not have to be to becoming a mother like any other friends of hers or colleagues. That was her earlier explanation as to why she delayed as long as she delayed.
Mm-hmm.
So when she tried so many times on her own, she considered that maybe she could adopt or even go become childless. But she was very wavering on that, to do or not to do, go through IVF or not. And at that point in her treatment, she was describing how she was feeling shame-ridden, and she felt defective, and she didn't have any kids. Whenever she would see another mother with the child, she would have this feeling of intense envy.
Before you read a piece about that, I'm wondering what it was like. Here she was in the office with you 4 times a week, you're both a professional, and did she know about whether or not you had children, and did that live in the office in any way?
She discovered later, because at first she was behaving as if she didn't have any interest about my personal private life. However, there was one time that a friend of her apparently told her that there was a fundraising, and I showed up with my daughter, and the friend reported to her that, yeah, Dr. Mann came with a young girl. It must have been her daughter. So that was when it ignited her curiosity about my personal life, whether or not children, how many, and so forth. That's when she started questioning, you know, whether I was, you know, fertile woman, I gave birth to a child, you know, what kind of life I had. So that envy stretched itself in our interaction.
Okay.
Of me being a mom and she not being a mom. And that came out in that particular way. Mm-hmm. So I could tell you one thing where it was very important, because she was the second born of a family of three kids. And Jean Brothers was born when Jean was 8 years old. And she remembers that her parents were very overjoyed because they finally had a son after so many years, and as if they were really waiting, and her birth being a girl didn't really matter. And they just waited until 8 years later they had a boy. But in her own, you know, day-to-day life, she was taking a lot of pride in being, you know, I could, because of the privacy, I'm not going to tell you about
profession,
but working, she also was working with people, clients. But at this point, you know, she also was kind of making me feel as if I wasn't doing good enough job as an analyst, or just we were just doing a talking and not turning it into some kind of an action for her to become mother. And she would report that whenever she would go to supermarket, like the women with their kids, the woman in their stroller, she would feel very intense envy and feeling of hatred, that how could they are able to become mom and that she couldn't. So this intensity became even more so during this particular part of her psychoanalysis. And she was able to tell me that maybe she's flawed and she's never been endowed with good eggs. Regardless of that, she decided to go, at this point, decided she's going to have to use the IVF, just like it's a new technology, why not her? So she ended up having multiple IVFs. It was like 7 IVF, one after another, that she was just so gung-ho about wanting to achieve motherhood and become pregnant. And each time she would come to the analysis and saying, with a lot of tears and feeling really bad, but at the same time, is mixed with rage and anger. You see, how come she failed, the IVF didn't, ignoring the fact that her eggs were quite old. And in fact, the fertility expert told her that this is going to be futile for her trying her own eggs. And the reality didn't seem to sink in.
And the issue of an egg donor, she refused. I think you wrote that in the book as well.
Yes, there was a time that she that came up, and she didn't want to borrow. Borrowing another woman's egg, it meant the gene was inferior to egg donors. And her husband was very supportive and suggested that, you know, maybe we could find someone who is anonymous donor. And she at first accepted that. But then she wavered on that. And she could only find anonymous donor from another country, not in USA. And perhaps she would consider that. At the end, she basically decided not to use the egg donor. And then this is when the process of the multiple IVF cycle started. Now, without showing any interest in exploring the meaning of her desperate actions. Only after many failures in conceiving, Jean was able to, you know, question why is it that she could not get pregnant.
Let me ask you a difficult question, because I in my introduction, I made clear that we know that dealing with the transference does not lead to pregnancy, and that's obviously true. New paragraph. When you say she wasn't interested in understanding why it was so anathema to her to, quote, borrow an egg, it's not as if you give it back, and why at 49, when her doctor said this is not going to work, she went through seven of these. And for our listeners who are at all familiar with this, it is a gruesome process. I mean, with multiple injections, and it's a very, very arduous thing. And for someone to go through seven of them at the age of 48 and 49, when you've been told it's not going to work, there's something awry in their consciousness, their awareness. Did you wonder whether her refusal to acknowledge reality, and including her refusal to acknowledge the reality of time passing, that might be part of why she's in this predicament? Why she's infertile at 49 and trying these essentially magical solutions?
Yes, it's a massive denial that she was in using it. Turning away from the reality of the quality of her eggs. The egg factor is a one big thing. The sperm factor was nothing wrong with. The sperm was okay. And in terms of her own magical thinking, that her eggs, she wanted to prove that she can have healthy eggs, still at that advanced age. That was really challenging for me to hear as an analyst that consistently she was in a very massive denial. Yeah. That I felt like helpless how to multiple times remind her, look, you know, that, you know, there is such a thing, particularly herself being in the medical field. It was mind-boggling for me to see how her defense was so rigid and insisting that, you know, she must be able to make her own advanced, you know, aged eggs into viable eggs so that the IVF would succeed. Mm-hmm. And that was really a counter-transference issue for me. To make a dent into that rigid. Eventually, she was. This, I agree. I think this was such an arduous, difficult kind of going through this cycle, getting injected, getting hopeful. Mm. And she would come and feeling, and back of my mind, I said, well, this, it's going to fail, knowing that it wasn't going to be a fresh egg, viable eggs. Yeah.
Do you want to read a little bit, and then we're gonna take up the question, which is applicable in this situation, which is the whole issue of donor sperm and donor egg. But why don't you read through a little bit about Jean?
Well, there is a part that I want to pick here. It says she continued to seek the creations of a baby from her own eggs fertilized by her husband's sperm after. Which I mentioned, seven trials without any success. She regretted putting herself through such vigorous procedures for a woman her age. She became more interested in the meaning of her loss. Finally, she had to face it and go through the grief stages. And she realized that she could no longer hold on to her dream. At the end, Jean realized that she could neither have a genetically related child, nor could she accept another woman's egg. After all, she could not picture herself as a nurturing mother. And she concluded that it may be for the best not to become a mother. And she could not like her own fertile mother and had to accept the reality of growing old. Finally, she was able to face her ambivalence, and Jean could learn to be more nurturing to the vulnerable part of herself. At this point, the memory of her brother's birth came up, and her rivalry with her became a central theme
with him
in our work. I have a bit of a dialogue. I could
know
what you said, what I said in that particular segment over time. Okay, this is an example of how she characterized her own envy. She said, "I have all these mean thoughts and I feel really bad." I said, "Carrying the mean thoughts make you feel guilt." She said, "It's very, very harmful to be occupied with them." I said, "In our last hour, you mentioned how hard it was to deal with jealousy at your brother's birth." She said, "Yes, Mom was mad at me for being jealous of my brother. I am never good enough. Other people have talents and values, not me. There is this other part of me that's irrational and unkind. There was always a feeling about my chance of getting pregnant with IVFs. How many attempts I made to give birth was like pushing a pickle through a straw. How many mean thoughts I would have. I am trying to make sense of these feelings. I'm flawed, but I want to be saintly and have power to make these women lose their babies or relinquish them when they are born. I have those mean, evil thoughts. I am torn again all the time. It ran through my mind that if I had a special power, the technology would have worked for me. I would have gotten pregnant by now. Technology is amazing and works for others, but not me. There is a zinger in that. I did not want to have a flawed child, so maybe it was for the best that I did not get pregnant." I stop here. Shall I?
Yeah, why don't you just read on, just to put closure on what happened with her.
Okay. After many years of attempts, Jean was in a place to make a decision to adopt a one-year-old girl from China. And this was a reasonable compromise for her after so many years of struggling with her desire to have her own biological child. Our analytical work had helped her to work through her early mother-daughter and Oedipal conflicts.
Thank you for that. There are so many themes that those of us who have worked with such patients are so familiar with, the whole notion of being flawed and then being perfect. And the alternative of being reasonably capable, not the narcissistic position of flawed or perfect, but the object-related human reasonable position of being reasonably capable or always always in an effort to be reasonably capable, which leaves open rooms for hope, for grief, for mourning, for pleasures, to help people find that space, which in this way you were able to do for her in terms of the reasonable solution of her adopting the child.
Exactly.
So it's a wonderful example. We could spend the rest of
one
our time together.
I want to add, Harvey, because she, just without revealing too much, but she was attracted working with dying patients. So death and dying and loss was in her professional world. It was a daily kind of occurrence. So here she also subjected herself to this multiple losses and, you know, rising her hope, for something that was unrealistic, and then loss of the, you know, hope for the becoming pregnant. Yeah, I think I find it fascinating, the connection.
Sure. And one of the things she brings up is an important topic in the world of infertility, and that is donorship, whether it be sperm donating or egg donating. And this is something that applies to straight couples, gay couples, some trans couples. And you have experience with it, and it brings up just so many issues, donor issue, about who one gets as a donor, someone you know, a relative, someone you don't know. How do you pick the person? And with that is, how and when do you tell children? Which also touches on the issue as that applies to adoption, which is also relating to infertility, which we're not going to have time enough to cover extensively. And it also, like this case brings up, touches on the issue of deciding not to have children. These are all part of the infertility world. But tell us about the issue of donors. How, what your experience has been with donors, what you've learned about the struggles about how to think about donors. Share with us what it's been like for you.
You know, the word, Harry, you're asking that what has been my experience about the psychology of the donors.
Well, there's that, and there's also the people who need the donors. The infertile couple who need an outside egg or sperm.
Yes.
And what that's like for the family, et cetera.
Well, those are the cases that they come to terms with, that the fact that they are infertile and they got to get some help outside. Either they go to anonymous donor or they find someone who is biologically related, like, let's say, which in this case, I have one woman who was in analysis with me. Used her niece's egg. Okay, right. So the family member becoming a donor. And the same thing could happen with the sperm too. But the cases I had, it was more like a donor eggs that came from relatives. So that itself, it also creates a complication afterwards. One case that comes to my mind, the niece, they agreed wholeheartedly, wanting to help her aunt who was infertile. And the baby was conceived by the niece's egg, and then her husband also had to borrow sperm from very close friend of his. So well, none of this were biologically related in this particular case. So, and then a few years later, and this woman, after, you know, analysis, she came back to see me because she was having trouble not knowing how to handle the resemblance that Denise had with her daughter that she was raising. You know, in other words, in any family gathering, Christmas and Thanksgiving and whatnot, they were together. And so the little girl, the daughter, was conceived with, you know, gravitate, or at least in her own mind, she thought because this was a biological mother, the daughter was attracted to the biological mother. And so, and the mother, but the niece also was attracted to this girl because it was biologically.
Sure.
Yeah. So it was all in the family. But there are all pros and cons about having the biologically related, or going through family, or going outside anonymous. In some way, maybe even anonymous, it might be less complicated because you could say, well, this wonderful, kind lady who is helping us, helped us to have you, and I'm so happy to have you in creating and who you are.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the residual effects of using a sperm or an egg from a relative. You used the same word that was used, I think, before when you said the husband borrowed the sperm from his friend. It's a fascinating notion that they borrow because of, you're not, of course, borrowing. You're asking for and receiving, you're getting, but you're not borrowing it. But it suggests that there's an ongoing connection, which is what you then refer to. And in the book, you describe in other chapters cases where, just like you said, there's a family resemblance. And the mother of the child, non-biologic mother, but the essential mother, has all kinds of feelings about, like you just said, the resemblance. And with the resemblance, is there a biological vibe that connects them? And does, in that case, the niece's children know that their half-sister? Mm-hmm. And in one of the cases in the book, where a man chooses his good friend to provide the sperm because he loves his friend, and he, what could be better than to have this friend give him his sperm? And it all sounds great on paper, except the son is born, and the father, the essential father, not the biological father, then has all kinds of concerns and possessiveness because his son looks like the sperm donor. And the same thing when they're together, and who's going to be excluded. And you mention that there's a common fantasy of that the donor will come back and take the child.
Mm-hmm.
Even though apparently in the real world, in the legal world, that essentially never happens, that it is a common fantasy that the actual parents have.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also the issue, and this in the book is written about, also about gay couples, when, again, there's one is borrowed either egg or sperm. The term used is a genetic asymmetry, and about whether there's an unfairness. If one parent is a biological parent and one parent isn't, what does that mean for the family? And then we come to the question of when do you tell the child?
Yes.
And I should tell you about how that question has been taken up around adoption. I have heard analysts be as varied in their answer, with one answer, one analyst, when asked, when should I tell my child about his being adopted? The answer is never. And the other answer from someone else was, well, as soon as they can understand it, which for them they were implying at a very, very young sort of toddler age.
Yes.
So it's one of these things you can't run an experiment about. But talk to us about your experience with this very trying question.
Well, Harvey, you brought up several important themes. And the word borrowing, it's really common. I borrowed their word. Borrow.
Uh-huh.
That's what they've used the word, to borrow, as if you're going to return that.
Yeah, yeah.
You take it, but you take it. It's not like a piece of bread.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Take it back. That's one thing. The other thing is that, yes, the whole asymmetry create issues, complications. It impacts us. Or put a strain in a relationship. Who is excluded? Who is more, have the right, the birthright to this, the product? In other words, that if it's, let's say, a sperm donor is from a stranger, so the chances of the, father feeling, am I really adequately, sufficiently related that I could claim fatherhood? Okay, so we are talking about psychological parenting, psychological mother, as opposed to gestational mother, and then genetic mother or genetic father, genetic, in this case, it brings the gestational mother into the mix too, because the surrogate mothering comes into that picture too. So the relationship of the surrogate mother to the child and the future of that relationship, who would determine that? It's a negotiation between the surrogate as well as the family who go to a surrogate to do that. So I have had several cases that I know in the interest of time, we can't go through all of that, but that's a whole other area of that, how it could facilitate the whole communal sense of motherhood of some sort. I'm calling it that way because it's sort of a shared motherhood. Or you could be very clear. Okay, you were the one who was very nice, altruistic woman who decided to do this surrogacy for us. And now you're going to say goodbye. Hmm. And we will let the child know that who you were. Or conversely, you're going to be part of our family. We are going to invite you to holiday, birthdays, and whatnot. So that could include, I've seen both, you know, uh-huh. a family who didn't want to have anything to do with the surrogate mother, goodbye. And another family that actually there was a psychoanalyst. I won't mention the name, but it's...
Please don't.
But anyway, it was a book review I wrote. They were very open. The surrogate mother was part of the family, and they were sort of sharing motherhood, you know, your biological and psychological and all of that. It's very interesting how to break the news, when to do that. That was bring us back.
Yes, bring us back, because you have a case of that issue of when does a parent tell a child about the variety of things that might be unusual about their birth. And what's been your experience with that?
My experience is that what you said, some family, they resort to secrecy. And I think it goes back to their own feeling of wanting to show that in a false way, in a pretend way, that they are actually both psychological and biological and genetically related. To me, that creating a falsehood, and that secrecy is harmful because it's going to be coming out, and they discover. There comes a time that the child say, "Where did I come from?"
Sure, but all kids say that. Every child says that.
Child has that.
And the answer we give is based on what we think they're really asking.
Yes.
As opposed to just the manifest question. I say that because, and I'm not making the case for it, I'm just representing the case. And those who say wait as long as you can do so under the thought that you want the person's ego to be as fully fleshed out as possible so that when they get the news, they'll understand it as news as opposed to they'll experience it as a piece of their character, like a younger person would distort it to be. So the downside they feel of telling a four-year-old is that a four-year-old may understand the words but will only be overwhelmed by the fantasies that will develop from it. And if you wait till, let's say, teenage years, that yes, of course, somebody will have imaginings. We all always have imaginings, but they won't be, the ego will presumably and hopefully be intact so that they will just be imaginings as opposed to character disturbing fantasies of a troublesome sort. That's the case that's made to wait. Mm-hmm. What's your sense? You have an example of someone who was told in their 20s. Do I recall that right?
Yes.
It was, why don't you share that with us?
Both parents, they decided that to keep it secret. In other words, it was a donor. There was no donor egg. It was a donor sperm. And it was anonymous. But they, the parents could actually track it down and get the information from the sperm bank. But they decided not to, reveal anything. So in one of the a hike, this is a father and daughter, that they were very close psychologically, and it's a good relationship. And the father finally decided to say, the daughter asked that, don't you think my nose looks like, not quite yours yet, something about your nose mm-hmm. as opposed to my nose. And that's how it got started. They were on a hike together. And
the mother wasn't there.
The mother wasn't there, right. Okay. So the topic came up to her dating a young man. And here she graduated. She wanted to come to, she got accepted to law school. And it was like between undergrad and grad. Uh-huh. So father, daughter on a hike, and this came up. And the father was torn to tell, because she agreed with the wife not to say anything, keep it secret forever. Anyway, this came up as a kind of a shock. He wasn't prepared how to respond. So very spontaneously, you know what, daughter, you know, I have to tell you something. This is very important for me to tell you. This is what happened. You know, we had to go to a sperm bank and you're conceived. It's not my sperm, but I love you very much. I mean, you're my daughter. And she started just having a huge fit, crying and being in shock. And her reaction was that turning her back to the family for a while. Eventually, she I referred them to family therapy to work something, you know, so mm-hmm. To work this out, you know, come to terms with that. And the daughter for individual therapy, psychotherapy too. Eventually, years later, I heard that things are okay. But the point is that at that time, it came as a shock for the daughter, not knowing. Sure. Yeah, that's one example.
Though presumably, just to stay on that theme, it came as a shock, as of course one would expect, to somebody who was otherwise ego intact and a mature, you know, young adult.
Yes.
And you've had experiences where children have been told at a much younger age?
That I can't remember anyone, but I think I've heard secondhand that some people, they err towards telling the child as young as like 3 or 4. To me, that's way, way too young, because they don't really have the cognitive ability.
Yeah.
Emotional, as you said, the ego is very not mature to be able to put distinct information together to see what it means. So I would think that around age, the toddlerhood, I mean, it's one thing about the adoption, and I think there are some common, commonality, you know, in other words, when to tell the child the same thing with the adoptive family,
yeah.
as opposed to the one for the donor sperm and donor egg situation. I would think that probably from age 6 onward, they have 6, 7. Each case, of course, is different. By and large, that it's just like the issue around death, the irreversibility of death. Around age 6 or max 7, the child knows when you're gone, you're gone. You know, when there is a death in the family. To me, that could be a good time to discuss it. You could say something very, if the question comes from the child, then you don't want to avoid answering it. You keep the answer very simple and age appropriate, not complicated detail. But if it doesn't come, and you know, you could introduce the idea of the how children are being made. You know, in that context, you could also introduce the fact that you had to get help to get this happen, to have the child to be conceived through, you know, either relatives or other ways.
Hmm.
Yeah. I hope I'm answering that question, am I?
Certainly. In terms of the timing, yes. But in terms of the issue, in terms of donor sperm or donor egg, and you may or may not have had cases like this, where, for example, where the niece contributed the egg.
Mm-hmm.
Do you tell the child that the niece is the biological mother? Or when do you tell the child? Or how have you seen that happen, especially with family members with whom you have ongoing relationships?
Yeah, with this particular case that I told you, the case that I borrowed, I helped her to prepare her because she's the one who needed to be ready for it, not kind
she
of...
She the mother or she the daughter, the patient?
She the mother, the psychological... Mother.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's the one who came back after a few years of analysis to say, how am I going to handle this situation with the family gathering and this... And she got very anxious and didn't know whether or not she should tell the truth and when to tell the truth, how to say to the daughter that, yes, your biological mom is my niece. Okay. To introduce that as a factual kind of, information that the daughter needed to hear. That at that age, the daughter was like 3 years old. I doubted that the three-year-old could really understand what that meant. Sure. But she was open to that because she was in the field. Mm-hmm. Also, one advantage, she understood that sooner or later she has to break the news.
Right.
Yeah.
Do the experiences you're describing lead you to suggest to people who come to you for guidance for this? Are you inclined to suggest away from using family members or close friends as donors, or do you not have a general rule of thumb?
Well, I hear some infertile couple, they opt for the family member.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I remember even one case. It was a father who had a son, was a teenager son, 17 years old, and this father's sperm had mobility problem, the second marriage.
Uh-huh.
So the wife wanted to have a child, never had a child. So the father was thinking, what could I do? Genetically close enough to me. He started telling me he's thinking about his son.
Well, I'm waiting to hear your response to this.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what was your response?
I said, we got to really think about it very hard.
Yeah.
Sure, I mean, your immediate thought was your son only.
Yeah.
But in any event, he eventually decided not to, opted for anonymous sperm donor rather than this. But this was his thought. He said, but biologically, who could he go to? It's just my son. But not thinking ahead to see what's going to create.
Yeah, I wish we could take a snapshot of all the people listening to this as we're saying, because you and I both have this guffaw smile on our faces as you tell that story and he's considering the son. And I'm wondering how many people listening to this will have the same kind of reactions, like, your son, some outlandish reaction to it. There's so much more we could talk about, but I want to grab the last few minutes, Molly, because on a different subject, on a manifestly different subject, you are a senior child analyst, and I don't want our time together to finish without our touching base on the state of child analysis in the United States, and I hear about it throughout the IPA world, that it is in dire straits. That the number of people going into it is shrinking, the number of cases they are able to get for training purposes are down, and that the field is really struggling. And when you and I chatted a bit about this, you shared with me spontaneously some thoughts you have about it, and take the floor to share it to a wider audience.
Well, I don't have the solution, but I agree with you. I think there's, we are in a dire need of getting help and having more revitalizing the field in child analysis. I mean, I believe the child analysis is very, very helpful because, you know, of my background and what the training I had and so forth. But in terms of, there are two things, I think, at least in USA, the insurance is an issue, okay? Family can't really afford to bring the kids four times a week to your office for analysis. And that's a struggle for candidates to find a case, no doubt. So, and insurance is the industry, the system is the way. But in European colleague, I don't think that they have the issues the way we do. Even with adult analysis, we are having trouble, let alone the children. Okay. Now, whether or not there is any hope for that, and part of it is because of the, you know, where we are right now in our history of mankind. You know, everything is high tech and the learning and everything, AI and whatnot. So it's almost could be looked at as kind of old fashioned, outdated, four times a week or three to four times a week. Bringing a child for play therapy, doing child analysis. I think there may be a way to go around that. For those of us who don't mind to get out of our own office and be out there in the school, you know, we can go to the classroom or go to the school to help. You know, we really have to make sacrifice and in order to offer that kind of a help that the children they need. And if we really are having a conviction that it could be very useful to do that, that frequency and the expertise that we have to offer that to kind of population that they actually need, the populations of the children and adolescents, then we will go after it and make it happen. I mean, it's easy said, but doing that is important for us to extend ourselves and getting ourselves out of the office and being out there, you know, in the classroom, a school, you know, residential facility, mm-hmm. whatever we can do to do that. Just like Gil Clyman had done this therapeutic.
Absolutely. Sure. I was thinking of him as you were talking. Yeah.
Yes.
And if you don't mind the reference, it's to the podcast title. It would be doing on the work, on the couch work, off the couch. It's like taking our work and not limiting it to people who come to our office, because that's a struggle right now, but to bring this skill and do it in the classroom or do it in the residual center or do it in their home. And that way it would be able to engage the intensity that can be so valuable for children.
Yes, yes. And Freud had done that too, see?
Yes, yes. A point well yeah, made, yes.
Right.
There is so much, each one of these themes we could continue to talk about. Thank you so much. I enjoyed your book. I enjoyed hearing about your experiences. And thank you for participating. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation. My pleasure. I hope we talk again at some point.
Indeed. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.